set of makaros is the Mishnah and Tosefta, which is the only part that I want you to particularly do. It's actually a longer handout which contains Dovi, all of the Midrashei Halacha on these passages. I only put on the first sources that I sent you a small piece in the Mechilta, the Rashbi. Most of the stuff in the Mechilta, there's nothing, just a word for those who aren't familiar. Most of you probably have not studied Midrashim intensively. Your knowledge of Midrash Agada or Halacha comes primarily through Rashi and through Chazal, Gemara, and the Bavli. There are many works of Midrash that we have redacted as separate works. Midrash Agada, you're probably more... I don't know which you're more likely to have seen, that Rashi will quote all over the place, like Bereishis Rabbah. Oh, Ben, you're thinking back to last year. But for our purposes in studying Gemara, for the most part, the more interesting, and usually Halacha, are the Midrashim of the Tanoim, Midrashei Tanoim, which are generally, it's not all Halacha, but it's primarily Midrashei Halacha. There exists nothing on Sefer Bereishis, not surprisingly. On Sefer Shmos, we have two Mechiltas, the one that we've had for a long time, the Mechilta of Rabbi Shmuel, and the one that disappeared, but has been reconstructed, the Mechilta of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Mechilta of the Rashbi. On Vayikra, the Medrash Halacha is known as either the Sifra or the Toras Kohanim. And then on Bamidbar, you have a Medrash Halacha, you have two. There's a regular Sifrei and a Sifrei Zuta. And then on Dvarim, you also have two Midrash Halacha, well, one or two, one reconstructed more recently. You have the Sifrei Dvarim. And you also have, I think they call it Medrash Tanayim and Dvarim. I'm not sure if it's the same thing or different than the Mechilta of Dvarim, one of them, or if it's the same thing, but David Tzvi Hoffman was the one who put out. Again, it's sort of a reconstruction from passages found elsewhere in Chazal. So the Midrashei Halacha are Tanaitic, probably compiled around the time of the Mishnah. So most of the stuff, many times Mishnayos are cited, not Tanan, but they're cited, you know, Mikan Omru, and you'll see really it's a citation of the Mishnah found in the Midrashei Halacha. So I only put on today's source sheet just a little bit because it's particularly interesting, Shita. You can, if you have time, if you want to read through the rest of the Midrashei Halacha as well. But tomorrow we'll probably start in Shira. I assume we'll finish these Makaros today or just about, is you'll start working on the Mishnah and Tosefta, which I will send you. And the reason I'm sending it to you is twofold. Number one is that the text of the Tosefta printed in the back of the Gemara, you know, would qualify for federal disaster aid. And number two is that I've interwoven the Tosefta with the Mishnah for you, so that you can see, because Tosefta has a complicated relationship with the Mishnah. It's a nice way of putting it. And so rather than reading one and reading the other, it's easy if you sort of read the material interwoven. Some of it repeats, but some of it is really just commentary on the Mishnah. Dean?
The Sifra and Tarkhanim are the same thing?
Same thing, yes, just two different names.
The formatting thing with the Tosefta and the Mishnah, like you usually do.
Yeah, you'll see them. They're distinguished in fat. So, the Tosefta that is used, that both texts are taken from the Bar Ilan. The Mishnah text is not. It's the standard Mishnah text. It is what it is. It's not the greatest text in the world, but that's what has been standardly printed. The Tosefta from the Bar Ilan is Lieberman's Tosefta, where it exists, and it does exist here. It exists up until the end of Baba Basra, from the beginning of Shas. So you'll get that from me probably later today, and that's what, if you finish the Makaros, even if you haven't finished the Makaros, we finish them in Shir, you move on to the Mishnah and Tosefta. Okay, and then after that, I promise we will get to Gemara. Might be Yerushalmi first, but we do Gemara. Okay, so we had finished, I think, we hadn't finished. I had some more questions. I wasn't done. So we had just spoken about, I think, Mahor, Yimaren, Alod, Yisha. Was that the last thing we spoke about? We talk about the verb, we spoke about the binyan of the verb. And we spoke about a little machlokas Rashi and Ramban, whether ksuba is the rice or not. The truth is, Rashi Shita here is just Rashi just quoting from the Mechilta.
I think we just stopped that or so. I mean, we did the
We did the
grammar for Lo Asa.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Fine. You're right. I have to remember what I talk about with guys in Seder and what we talk about in Shir and what's going on in my own head. Fine. So, Ashelo Orasa. Okay, so here, already both Rashbam and Ibn Ezra, and I'm not sure it's Lafuke Mechazal, but they say Ashelo Orasa means that she is not Me'uresas. Right? What's that? Yes. So Ashelo Orasa means she's not currently Me'uresas. I don't think, again, Ibn Ezra is almost certainly not coming to take a stand. Rashbam is more likely to be saying something behavla'a to sort of kalachar yad, you know, being mevatel a certain sheet of Chazal in terms of pshuta shel mikra. In this particular case, he can't really go that wrong, because if he's being mevatel Rabbi Yosei Galili, it means he's adopting Rabbi Akiva's reading. But I think Rashbam is probably telling you that he thinks, you know, that pshara shelo arasa is not that she never had erusin, but rather she's not currently meureses. Okay, so then mishachavi mada. This is an interesting. This is actually sort of expected language. Daniel and Eli, did you come up with anything in your concordance peregrinations about v'shachavi ma v'shachavosa? No. Okay. You mean you didn't detect any pattern or something? One of the questions that I don't know that there's an answer to, sort of just a. Let me stay focused on this part. There's a question of biblical terminology in terms of the sexual act generally. And what specific types of terms, you know, how certain nuances of certain formulations. One of the questions that I wonder about is whether or not there's a difference between v'shachav ima versus v'shachav osa. And I wonder about that because if you look at Dina and Shechem, for example, which is the quintessential story of rape, so it's v'yishkav osa v'yaneha, right? Not v'shachav ima. And intuitively, instinctively, I would read v'shachav ima implies consensual, and v'shachav osa implies forced. Now, in this particular parasha, it reads just fine. V'shachav ima works nicely because it's tifateh. I think that at the end of the day, and I probably won't mention it again, but even under the current, if the California law passed already, you know, I think that if he uses his powers of rhetoric that he picked up in class to persuade this young woman to join him, I don't think that that constitutes a violation of date rape. I don't think so. And therefore, it would still be, even though yifateh, even though yishadel, even though he promises her the moon, nonetheless, that would be considered consensual. So that's v'shachav ima. The question is, how does that read when you get to the Psukim of Ones? Because there it's also v'shachav ima. And I'll talk about that when we get there, but just one comment. Well, I'm going to talk about that now. I don't want to forget to talk about it. I'm not convinced, however, that there really is a difference from a semantic perspective, because one pasuk that pops into my head, I didn't do a survey, but v'im shachov yishkav ish osa shich... No. I'm not thinking about that one. That would also be v'shachav ishosa shechaser. I'm thinking about bo'el nida. Im shachav ishkav ishosa usahini dasa alav. Yeah, shechaser apaptamet. That's why I did something wrong in the pasuk. Usahini dasa alav. So again, by bo'el nida, there's no distinction between baratzon and ones, and there's no reason to assume that parasha is talking about rape. It's not that the din happens to be, for those who are not familiar, it's a psukim in parashas Metzorah. If a man is bo'el and nida, he is tameh for 7 days. But there, shachov yishkav ish osa, or certainly by sota is a better raya because that has to be consensual. Because pshuto shomikra is v'hilo nispasa. So osa, you can have shachav osa when they're actually willing. So I don't think that I don't know why it would have been a very natural distinction, but the distinction doesn't seem to hold. Hold on 1 second. On the question. The comment that I made to a couple who asked me this question in the Seder is that there's a very interesting din. It raises all sorts of psychological questions. Chazal talk about a case of tchilasa ba'ones v'sofa baratzon, where initially he forces her into the act, but by the time the act is over, she has been swept away by desire and she doesn't want to stop. And the now that, you know, that sounds like some type of sadistic fantasy, you might put it that way. But Chazal talk about such a category. It comes up not only in the Inksubos I think it's in the fifth parak, but it's also an issue, and that may be for different reasons. It's a funny kind of ratzon of the Nara who says, leave him alone, don't, even though he's raping her because she's afraid that he'll kill her. Now, that obviously is closer to Ones. Lest you think that this is totally, that this category is totally absurd, this idea of Tchilasa v'Ones Sofa Ratzon, I mentioned to those of you who asked me, there was a case many years ago in Texas. In which a man who was on trial for rape, the woman asked him before he raped her to use a condom, which he consented and did, and he wanted to claim in court that that implied consent. I believe he was convicted. But lest you think that it is so far removed, it was a case that was argued in court, whether such a situation, which clearly Bichlalusa does not biratzon, whether or not there can be partial consent that changes the nature of the act. Now, the Shailim, the Gemara discusses in Ksubas, is whether Kliyas HaBonus Sofa Biratzon is considered Mizana Biratzon to be Neseres Labaila and the like. And I don't remember if it's a Machlokas, but they have a Drasha from the Pesukim of some kind. But I did wonder if in fact, you know, I'll call it Alderach HaGra, the kind of thing the Gra might say, is that Peshachav Ima, perhaps the formulation, even by Ones, which is clearly, in life terms, a case of a Shachav Osa, perhaps the remez there is that even when it's Peshachav Ima, even when it's Sofa Beratzon, because it's Tchilasa Beones, it has the din of Ones. Just not sure, but I was wondering about that idea. Whether that's merumas in the formulation, the parish of Ones, of Shachav Ima, when it should have been Shachav Osa, to teach us that even in a case of Ones, which is partially Shachav Ima, it's in the parish of Ones. It's probably pushing it.
Wouldn't you want to say that for the case of Yifateh, that you would maybe...
No, because there it's all Baratzon. It's all Baratzon. So you can't... You're not going to use the reverse formulation. That wouldn't make any sense. But in other words, what you could be arguing, again, I think it's a stretch, is that the Torah is being merames in the parish of Ones, that even when there's an element of a Shachav Ima, it's still Dina Ka Ones. Okay. Fine. Akivi, still your question, or I answered it?
I was just wondering, when you said Nida, someone's tummy for 7 days, so whether it was Chayav Karis.
That's a separate question. That's unrelated to my question. Separate question.
Okay. Question.
Yeah.
We said Yifateh was a bit more than seduction, meaning psychological.
Well, the Ramban is going to say, right. I'll talk about that when we get to the Ramban and the implications of that. So let's wait a little bit on that. Okay. Fine. So now, Mahar Yimharena Loli Isha. So here you have the Machlokes, Rashi, and Ramban, how to read it. Rashi, I don't think, by the way, you can assume is taking a position on the machlokas whether ksuba deraisa, ksuba derabanan. Rashi's just quoting Kedarka Bakot. She's quoting the Mechilta. Rashi does that keseder in certain sections of Chumash. He relies heavily upon Midrashei Halacha. And so you can't assume that that is Rashi's shita himself. Ramban, clearly you can see, assumes that ksuba is the rabbanan, which I think is the predominant position amongst Rishonim. Adin?
Can you go even to as far as say that the Mechilta's position isn't really like Ksuba is there?
It's probably if the Ramban would say it's an Asmachta.
I think you could even argue I think you could read both this. You could read that Rashi is saying that Ksuba is there, right? So, okay. I think when you could even read the Mechilta is saying that Ksuba isn't there, right? So that just that marry her, and what for us today would be is write her Ksuba and marry her. But that.
Okay, so here's the point. So I was talking to a couple of this. You're asking the question of what happens when the Torah records a minhag. Now, if Mohar Yemar Nalisho means Ksuba, so you want to argue that, well, the Torah is not saying a Ksuba is obligatory, but it was the Minog at the time of Matan Torah, so the Torah speaks in those terms.
There was money, but not a formal Ksuba.
I don't know what that means. You don't have to write Ksuba. The Gemara talks about Makomos that they didn't write Ksuba, it was just assumed, and it's binding. It's legally binding. When you marry a woman, it's enforceable. Right, and then after meaning is, do you need to produce the piece of paper? So there is such a thing as a makom shein kosvin ksuba, but the obligation is there regardless. But if the Torah speaks about an obligation of ksuba, does that mean therefore ksuba is an obligation that min haTorah you must write a ksuba when you marry a woman? What I mentioned, I don't think I've ever seen it myself inside, but it's been quoted that I think that the Netziv in his commentary, probably on Sifrei Bamidbar, on the discussion of a woman, married woman covering her hair, faras rosh haisha, the makor that a married woman covering her hair is deraisa is based upon the parish of Sota. It's a Gemara in Ksuba Stafayin Beis, in which the Gemara says Ufaras Rosh Aisha. It's a Tana Beri Bishmael that you see Mikan Lenos Yisrael Shenan Yotzes Puros Rosh Lashok. So the question is, and the Kohen is shaming her here when he's going through the ritual by uncovering her hair, by burying her head. But the question is, the Torah doesn't say you have to cover your hair, it's just you see derech agav that was the minhag of Benos Yisrael. So the question is, a minhag mentioned by the Torah, does that bind him midoraisa or not? It's possible. It's possible you could say that even if Mohar referred to Ksuba, that it wouldn't mean that the obligation to write Ksuba is deraisa. It just means that the minhag at the time of Matan Torah is to continue to be long afterwards, and into the period of Chazal, who may have formalized it and made it a strict obligation, even if it's only Torah, but it's Ksuba. Yeah, it's possible. David?
I remember reading some sort of paper, I don't remember like who wrote it, but it was an Israeli sort of academic scholar. Okay. He said that like minhagim like Nahagim first, like they began as Nahagim, and then they progressed into Darabanan, and then eventually Darais. Obviously, it's secular, but I think that has some sort of truth that like certain things that like were traditional in ancient Mesopotamia became part of the Torah and became Darais.
So I don't. Well, that's a totally different stuff.
No.
What I mean by that is that but if it was an ancient Mesopotamia, it means the Torah may have incorporated it. That's an argument of what Torah Shebuch Tzah meant in the first place when the Torah was given. The other argument is an argument that has merit to in some cases. Certainly, I'll just state the following. Very often, things that are made of the Tzibor eventually became Dinim de Rabbanon, certainly because the inverse is true as well. A Gzeira that the Tzibor didn't accept was not binding. Right? So okay. In any way, but the bottom line is that you could make such an argument. It's not Minan Nimna. Okay. Fine. Now, what does Mahar Yimarena mean, however? So here, Ibn Ezra has a comment. And as I said to a couple of you, and I'll say it again, because we all sometimes make silly mistakes at different points in our career in learning, and we're lucky when they aren't discovered when we say something stupid publicly, but rather than we figure it out on our own, and then, we know to avoid it. So I don't know how long ago it was that I realized that Mahar Yimarena didn't mean something like, a shotgun wedding, like hurry it up. Although Ramban, in one of his interpretations, does suggest that it means it's related to the same word, tahari. But Ibn Ezra already points out that it's not so. And why does it not mean to hurry up? Why does it mean they should get married in a hurry? It's the wrong binyan. Normally, whenever the word means to hurry, in fact, most occurrences of the root mem heresh are in binyan piyah, which is what the Rishonim called the binyan kaved or binyan dagush, because it has a dagish in the middle letter. So if you read it, Ibn Ezra writes here that Mahar Yimarena Kamo Mohar Binyan Kishur. It means dowry. It means something which you establish a bond with. And he quotes one example from Tehillim, Acher Maharu, which is again in the Kal, Maharu, which is the pausal form of Maharu. A Kigzeras Mahira, the meaning to do it hurriedly. Lotimtsa Bepoa, or Lotimatse, either one, Bepoalim. You don't find it in the verbs. Rak me habinyan hadagush b'chol hamikra. You don't find it b'chol hamikra except for the binyan hadagush. It only is found in binyan piel. Miher, vayimaher, and so on and so forth. So that's why mohar yimharena is related to mohar, which is a dowry. Habu alai mo'od mohar matan. Metzger?
Yeah. Uh-oh. That entire verb form shows up three times.
Indeed.
So hence, he's quoting Tzikantilma as his source, but then when it only comes up basically here and then in Tehillim, that's not necessarily a proof. If you're in Tehillim, that one clearly is referring to something else, because you cannot fit it in any form of being expediently. But as in here, like, it would fit in just fine. It could be that, yes, it can be used differently, that for...
So I would argue...
You could...
Okay, so why grammatically can't it mean to hurry?
Could we go over the grammar?
Okay, I didn't bring my. It's okay. I'm getting it with. We have caps, no markers. But okay, I still haven't found a shear assistant who's like Ben Yubin. He had everything in his jacket pockets. It's okay.
We'll take care of it. I'll put it on the agenda.
It's fine. It's fine. Then you have to put on a jacket because you need something to carry it in. So anyway, it's been many shear assistants since. Okay. So, thank you. So he's still not going to get his job.
Okay. Okay. If we had such a verb, it would be mohar. Okay. Mohar, yimhar. Okay. Sorry. Okay. This is a binyan kal. And that does not require, that does not get, even if it weren't a dagish in the middle letter. Okay. However, when you want to say that he hurried up, you would say miher. Now, there's no dagesh in the hay because the hay won't take a dagesh. But had this been diber, okay, you would have had a dagesh chazak in the resh, doubling the letter, that marks the binyan kaved. And then when you want to say in the future, you say yidaber, dagesh chazak in the beis. And in this case, it's yimaher, okay, with a no dagesh in the hay. Many guttural letters, and I won't say anything more on this, to compensate for the loss of the dagesh, has what we call compensatory lengthening, thank you, Nathan, in which a word, how do you say he blessed somebody? Beirach. You don't say, forget the patach is because the resh. Let's get a better example. Well, Orasa is by them a good example. How do you say, oh, it has the same problem with the Reish, but I'll give you a better example. How do you say he will speak, you will speak to daber, right? Okay, that's a normal form, to daber. How do you say you will engage a woman, isha? Se'areis. Okay, because the Reish doesn't take the dagesh, the patach lengthens into a kamat sandeah, it's called compensatory lengthening. So anyway, so you would have expected maher yimaharena lo the isha. The reason why that, even without the grammar, okay, Chaim, that's not going to be the case, is because then there's a verb missing. He should hurry, forget the doubling, that's just normal. He should hurry, lo the isha. Maher yimaharena lakachta lo the isha. The whole verb of marrying is missing. Whereas if Mahar Yemarena means he should dowryize her, which is another way of saying he should, thank you, marry her, so then it makes more sense. So in other words, it wasn't just the grammar that gave it away. But so I admit to my own youthful foolishness, and I don't care to admit when I think I figured that out, because that would be truly embarrassing. So that is that sufficient for the moment? You'll get the,
I just don't know if they do so well.
Okay, so that's why they're going to make you take Hebrew here and torture you. And then maybe you'll come out knowing that. But then you'll know compensatory lengthening, like Denikoff. Did you learn that in Hebrew, or you learned that from me? That's a mila. Okay, fine. All right, so Mohar Yim Harena Lo Lisha means he should make either a dowry, or Rashi says she write her ksuba. Fine. Now, in ma'en yima'en avi alisita lo, kesef yishkol. So let me ask you another question. I think I hinted at this yesterday. Mohar yimarena lo lisha, is that advice? Is that a mitzvah? Okay, so it is a machlokas. If you didn't learn the mechilta the Rashbi, you wouldn't know it's a machlokas. That's why it's here. Right, in the Gemara, in the Bavli, certainly, I don't think there's a, I haven't seen that part of the Perek in the Yerushalmi yet. In the Bavli, certainly, I don't think there's any dissenting opinion on this issue. Right, in the Bavli, it's universal. The Mishnah, okay. What does the Mishnah say? I want you to think about this question. The Mishnah says, what are the differences between Ones and Mefateh? So there are a few differences. One of them, forgive the metaphor, Ha'ones Shose Va'atzitzo Ha'Mefateh Imratza Lahotzi Yotzi, I think it's formula Imratza Lahotzi Yotzi, is that the way it says it? Which is actually very, I never thought about the formulation until now. What does Shosev Atito mean? What's in Atitz? A pot. Right?
So
is a pot a nice clear to drink out of?
No.
No. Okay, so you have to forgive the metaphor, but it's, you know, the contemporary expression in a store would be, you broke it, you bought it, right? So that's simply the formulation of the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, on Daf Lamed Tes probably, it says the following, Ha'ones Shosev Atitza V'mafata Imratza Lahotzi Motzi. And it explains, ketzad shose ba'atzito, how is it that the ones has to be drink out of the pot? He says, the Mishnah says, afilu hichigeres, afilu hisuma, afilu mukashchin. She can be lame, she can be blind, she can be smitten with boils. Nonetheless, he has to marry her. It's usher for him to marry her because she nimsa batvera, she commits adultery subsequently, or she is it's a yuchsin problem. So then he doesn't marry her. But as soon as if she is halachically eligible for her to marry her, he has no choice. It doesn't matter how ugly she is. It doesn't make a difference how repulsive he might find her. Ones is shosev atzito. Now, does the Mishnah say therefore imply that the mefata does not have to marry her? So it hit me this morning, not now, it hit me this morning in a few different sources in the other Mechilta that it doesn't actually say that. It says he has the right to divorce her. When it comes to an ones, the Rambam counts two mitzvahs. Number one is velosi elisha, and number two is lo yuchal shalcha kol yamav. He can't divorce her either. There are two mitzvahs there. One is the mitzvah to marry her, and the other is the mitzvah to divorce her. That has halachic ramifications. It's not simply a pilpul. There are reasons having to do with potential malchus and vow for divorcing her and so on. We'll talk about, if you read the Rambam, he explicitly discusses this issue. Not our discussion for now. But the bottom line is, by a mefateh, certainly it doesn't say he can't divorce her. It doesn't say lo yichal shalcha. But the question is he obligated to marry her?
Well,
Well, yeah, doesn't that imply that? It just implies that he's allowed to divorce her, but it could also imply that he's obligated to marry her.
Right, so the possibility should be raised that Mahariya marrying the means he has to marry her, he has to give it a shot. Yeah, he doesn't like it.
And the consent now goes to the father's household.
Ah, right. So, but provided that the father agreed.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, sir?
Wouldn't the Mishnah use some term that's more likely to divorce if that's the case?
Imratza lahotzi motzi.
But that's not a divorce.
Yeah, that's what the term in the Mishnah, the divorce. You bring in a wife, your kones.
Right.
Okay? Machnis leveso, and you divorce a wife. The standard term in the Mishnah is not Yigarshena, it's Yotzi. And throughout Mizrach Ksubas for sure. All over the place. In fact, right.
So it's not Yerishita.
Correct. And there's a very important machlokas that emerges over the meaning of the word, whether Yotzi and Kofin are the same thing or not. Big machlokas are Rishonim. Yotzi v. Ksuba versus Kofin. Major issue depends upon that. Yotzi.
What's the ratio of advice in the Torah versus something like this that would be a commandment?
Look, so I think intuitively, not intuitive, I think that if you were a Karaite, I'd be curious to know how the Karaites read this pasuk. I say that absolute seriousness. What I'm asking is someone who denies having a tradition of interpretation, or who doesn't have a tradition of interpretation, how would they read this verse? I'm curious to know what Qumran does with it as well. What's that? No, not now, but any of you taking, is scrolls being offered? No, it's Aramaic being offered. So some of you, any of you do scrolls in the past?
Yeah.
Twice, yeah. I won't say anything. So anyway, I'd be curious to know. If you have the chance in your free time, take a look and see how they read the pasuk. But I realized after reading them, again, this is one of those things, if you grow up really ensconced in a rabbinic culture, which in some ways I did more than some of you, meaning all of my learning and extensive learning came long before I was exposed to sort of academic ways of thinking, my initial stages. So for me, a lot of these things are sort of rediscovery. It's like how I would have read it, you know, it's hard to sometimes brainwash in the negative sense, but to unbrainwash yourself, in other words, how would you read this text if you're not a rabbinic reader? Almost all of you are coming from a rabbinic context, but you haven't necessarily read extensively, so you're still maybe a tabula rasa. So the question is, how would someone read Mahariya Maharena Lo Lisha? So I'm not sure. I think that whoever just asked the question, how often does the Torah give advice? Who asked that question? Right. I'm not sure how often the Torah gives advice. There is, by the way, an odd, very interesting case where Chazal take what appears to be a mitzvah and read it as advice by Benos Tafchad. When the Torah said that the Benos Tafchad have to marry within the Shevet, and any Basi Reshes Nachala, so the Gemara Babasu says that every Basi Reshes Nachala that generation had to marry within the Shevet, Benos Tafchad was only an Eitzah. I think there's a reason. I think there's a different agenda Chazal have in reading it that way, because it's not obvious in the Pesukim, but they're willing to read it as an Eitzah as opposed to a command. Yeah?
Chazal undo that one?
No, the Chazal say it was only applied to that generation. Mm-hmm. That they say the Gemara Mishnah Tainis, the Gemara Tainis says that
the reasons for
Tshuva
because they.
I understand, but but that said that everybody was only the first generation. But I'm saying within the first generation, the Gemara Bava Basra says that all the other inheriting daughters had to marry within the Shevet, but no Stachad were only advised to do so. It was an Eitzah, but they weren't Mechuyavos. It's Gemara Bava Basra.
Why would they separate it out?
I don't want to talk about why I think Chazal read that way, but the bottom line is that you have a case Chazal willing to read, right? They read that as an Eitzah, and that really sounds like it's a mitzvah.
But they did.
They did anyway, so whatever. I knew of that Gemara, even not having learned the Gemara, because a Rav once gave a drasha on it, explaining, wasn't that strange, if a Kaddish Baruch Hu wanted to reward them, and Gadol HaMitzuvah V'Osa, Mimi Yishen HaMitzuvosa, so why did Kaddish Baruch Hu turn it into a non-mitzvah for them? That whole hazard. Forget it, it's not because I know all of Shas and the Gemara, it stuck in my head, because it was such a surprising statement, that I went and I looked and said, yeah, the Gemara does say that way, as odd as it seems. Okay, so anyway, so Mahariya Maharena Lo Lisha could have been really an obligation. In other words, you broke it, you bought it, applies to Nefata as well. However, if the father refuses, and here you ask the question, well, what about the poor girl? So the truth is, it's a bothersome question. In other words, let's say the girl doesn't want to marry him. How do Chazal going to interpret? Chazal will interpret ma'ein yima'ein, the double language, she can also refuse. Now here's a very, it's a fascinating question which I haven't seen yet dealt with. And I have to look, I'm sure the Bavli must quote this, but I haven't seen the Rishonim on it. I know the Gemara quotes this. I haven't looked at the Rishonim on it. There's something very odd about this. What's very odd about the daughter's right to refuse?
That's
what? No. That conceptually, not asking a textual question. Denny? Yeah, certainly if she's a katana, but even a nara, the father has the right to be mekadesh or bal karcha. Right, the reason the Gemara is going to give that for the Mishnah states that the boshes and pegam go to her, go to the father, excuse me, is because it's biyado levaish or lepagma, because he could be moser her in marriage to a menuval or mukeshrin. So what? It's really interesting here. It's almost as if that normally a daughter doesn't have a right of refusal. Certain, now Chazal, by the way, said it's usher to do. Chazal say that it's that usher to a person to be mekadesh his daughter when she's a ketana until she ad shetagdil v'tomar v'ploni ani rotza. So on a moral level, without a doubt, such a practice is prohibited to marry off his daughter under normal circumstances without her will. But legally speaking, the father has the power to marry her off against her will. You know, when she's a ketana or even a nara. Even a nara. So therefore, this is really interesting because if you read in Ma'en Yemena Via, Lerambos, if she refuses, it's interesting. In this case, apparently because the relationship started on some type of a shaky footing, the Torah gives the daughter a right, at least when she's assuming maybe a nara. It's hard to imagine just to reply by katana. It gives her the right of refusal, which is very interesting. Now, yes, Yitzi?
Once we have advice,
No, because Yema'in Yemein Aviyah is clearly a din. If the father, it clearly implies that Torah has a right, the Torah has clearly given the father a right to refuse. It's not advice whether he should or shouldn't refuse one way or the other. If the father refuses, this is the din. When Chazal Darshan, Yema'in Yemein, the Rabos is Abbas, you can't say that that's advice. You know? Chazal, when I say the Chazal, do you read something as advice, they're going to be explicit on it. But Chazal say that even the mefateh has the right not to marry or just pay. Clearly, even though they're not formulated that way, they're reading Mohar Yomarana as not being mandatory. Yes, Benny?
Would the father be able to get around it by, if she does mew, he can then just go and do a kaddish her?
The problem is at this stage, then you're going to argue for a different legalistic concept here, but it's going to get very complicated. What does it mean then, in the absence of the father's refusal? Normally, for kiddushin, the father has it's not that the father's refusal; the father has to consent. So, what would the implication be here, according to your reading? And as in my reading just first right now, that would imply that if he doesn't refuse but doesn't consent, then he can marry her. That would also be now. The reason why I froze and I'm hesitant is because there's a whole discussion in the Gemara about a nara may also have rights to be mekabel kiddusheha if the father doesn't refuse. That's a whole sugya, I think, in kiddushin, I want to say in the second or third perek. So I don't remember how the maskana works out there. But to avoid that, I'd have to say, what if she's a katana? But that's even more radical. You might argue that if he's mefate katana, if the father then doesn't refuse, then you don't need his consent for kiddushin, which I find that would be also a radical concept. So somewhere, you're going to be pushing the boundaries of a sort of standard rabbinic legal interpretation. Well, that's what you're saying is possible. What you're saying is possible, but then that means you're going to have to take the first pasuk, Mahay Mar in the show, and read something very radical there. Yes, Yitzi.
Could you say that this change in status happens because she now, it's for her benefit that you force?
That's not a legalistic formulation. If you want to, you're right. No, it's clearly, if this will be a different case, it will be, the way I said it before, because she was harmed, so the Torah makes an exception. And you're presenting the flip side, is the reason why would, why a girl would want to marry her mefateh, we understand. If she was seduced by him once, presumably she might like him. Why would a woman ever want to marry the man who raped her? The answer is it might still be to our benefit because she's married now.
Meaning, if she didn't marry him because she...
Now she's a non-virgin single woman who wants to marry her.
And it's going to be much more difficult.
Agreed.
It's her benefit and that's why the father now loses his power to...
Okay, so one second. There was just a... So what's your... you want to say that just going back to the Mion part, not the way Benny was suggesting. Yes, the answer to the question is yes. If you want to read it that way, the Torah gives her a right of refusal in this specific case because you have to say it's not to benefit to her, it's to prevent the harm in this very in this precise scenario. If you want to present it as the benefit to her, you have to go with Benny's suggestion, which is here the Torah creates a special possibility of an institution of Kiddushin even without the father's consent, just without his refusal, because the Torah wants to protect her. Right? But then so you have to say is that it's that's the reason for doing it, but you still have to define the legal mechanism for it. Right? It's a quasi-emancipation. Not quite. Okay. Fine. So if the father, and Chazal say her, and some Chazal say even him, aren't interested, then kesef yishkol kamar b'solos. That's it, your question?
I was wondering what the relationship would be, let's say, if she was an orphan. Does the halacha the mother or the brothers marry her off?
So that's a Torah Shabbal Peh question. I'm going to leave it because the Torah doesn't discuss that scenario at all. And Chazal will talk about that. I don't want to talk about that right now. I don't know if I said this yesterday. Forgive me for repeating myself, but because of your question, I'll comment. Some of you might ask, somebody did talk with me, I think Dovi was outside of Shir, about my selection of Makoros and my agenda. Why am I doing this? Why am I reading these psukim? So I think that part of it is to see the psukim that Chazal read to understand what they're doing. The other part that I don't know if I mentioned yesterday, is that Chazal were very, very good readers of the text. They were extremely good textual readers. And I say that not out of a sense of reverence, but I do have great reverence for Chazal. I'm not saying I don't. But I don't say that when I say the Ramban was a super genius, I'm not saying that because it's a mitzvah you have to say all the Rishonim were Gedolim. I'm saying that because the Ramban was really a creative genius. There are other Rishonim who you might look at who were clearly Gedolei Rishonim they were all very smart people. Smart people, if you weren't smart in that period, your work didn't last. It's not like today where every, Yankel Ben Shmuel publishes a sefer and, violates Batashkas on the ink and the paper. Works that survive from the medieval period survived because they were worth preserving. Let's put it virtually all cases. So I say when Chazal were extremely astute textual readers, it's because they were. And I feel the need to say that because sometimes we tend to think that there's a total disconnect between Torah Shabbosav and Torah Shabbat. This should make a Torah Shabbosav very nice, but Torah Shabbat is something else, and we are rabbinic Jews. We believe in Torah Shabbat primarily. And if you're interested in Torah Shabbosav, very, very nice. Have fun, read Rashbam and Ben Ezra, on the side, and nice and move on. But what I've discovered over the years is that Chazal were very astute textual readers, and there's so much of Torah Shabbal Peh that finds its roots in a very, very careful reading of Torah Shabbosav. It's not always Peshuto Shel Mikra, but it's often something that a good reader realizes that there's a problem in the text. In this particular case, what's going on in Ones and Mefateh is a very natural textual tendency of harmonization of two texts that are clearly related to each other because they share terminology. Chazal do this in Torah Shabbal Peh. If you want to see it in Torah Shebichsav, go read the Samaritan Pentateuch. In the Samaritan in their Pentateuch, what they do all the time is that they, when you have two passages in Torah, in Tanakh, that are clearly related, almost the same passage, they level the two of them. And they make them the same on the assumption of, which Chazal also shared, but only in a Torah Shabbal Pah sense, of, I'll say it, Achas Diber Elokim Shtayim Zo Shamati, is that these two texts are talking about the same thing, and therefore they must say the same thing, and therefore the Samaritans, in fact, say in their Pentateuch, when they rewrote their Pentateuch, is that they do say the same thing, and they read the exact same way. Chazal would never ever do that to the text, but they often will fill in one text on the basis of the other. You see this in its closest form in Torah Shebichsav, where, to the students who took Targumim with me, in complementary complementary translations or associative translations of the Targum, where the Targumim do this, where they fill in one passage based upon the other passage, is exactly this harmonization of scripture, which Chazal do really just in Torah Shabbal Peh. Anyway, so that's why I'm taking your question and I'm totally pushing it off, because it's really a Torah Shabbal Peh question. The lacuna is in the text, but it's not addressed at all. Okay. Now, one comment. What does kesef yishkol mean? It's a funny term.
Weight.
Yes. You weigh kesef.
That's how you use money.
So one thing you should be aware of is that it does present one problem with one machlokas in Chazal, but that's probably the only place it presents a real problem. But it would appear, based upon all archaeological evidence, and there's nothing in Tanakh to contradict this, that in the period that we're talking about in Chumash and through most of Bayis Rishon, there were no coins. Shkalim is a weight. Now, when I first discovered this, or saw a student of mine teaching this in Camp Stone, didn't say a word, but I was a little taken aback and was concerned this might be, in the words of the YouTube vidi, kefara. However, after further thought and thinking more and more and more, I realized that, in fact, there's nothing in Torah Shebichsav, in the Bayis Rishon period, in the Torah, and in the Torah, as opposed to Divrei Hayam and Bayis Sheni, where you clearly already have coins, and in fact clearly do already have coins, archaeologically, historically, there's nothing in the Torah that suggests that these are actually coins. They're weights. Kesef Yishkol is the way you would have done it. You would have taken the silver and weighed it. They might have been little pieces of silver. I don't know if any of you know which is only one drush on Chazal which suggests the idea of there being coins in the time of Torah. You can deal with this. There are ways of dealing with it, of getting around the kasha. What's that? What? No, because he just arba me'o shekel kesef over la socher means it probably was the purity of the silver or something like that.
They interpreted it as he used the largest coin.
No, you don't have to read the pasuk that way.
Oh, really?
I want to know what halacha in Chazal. I don't need to worry about an agada or a medrash. What's that? No, because that's a weight. You see how it's ingrained? We're so used to thinking in the Medrash that he showed him the coin, right? Zeyitanu, right? But you don't go back to the text. You don't have to. There's nothing in it that ties your hands as a believing Orthodox Jew in that. Okay, it's an agada. Fine. That's not, that's not a problem.
Why is Shekel HaKodesh?
No, because it means that the weight that was used by the temple was of a different weight.
Oh, I thought it was like a holy coin.
No, again, the Ramban Adarab, the Ramban points out it means the shekel. What he thinks, he's thinking coin, but it's based upon weight anyway. The shekel HaKodesh was kafel. The mana of HaKodesh was kafel. The Ramban of Shekel HaKodesh says that obviously it's not intrinsically holy. That's how he explains Lashon HaKodesh, by the way. That's on that Ramban in Kisisa. Mati?
Doesn't
Kibbutz Ben
have to be done with the
Tzura? No, first Ben, I don't think requires. Again, it's a value and of a weight of silver. It doesn't. It still, but it still doesn't have to be, Hamisha Shkalim or Hamisha Slaim. It's just a weight. It's not pidyon. There's one halacha, the machlokas Rabbi Dos and the Chachamim by pidyon Maser Sheni, whether it has to be tzarta kesef sheyesh alav tzura. That's the only drush that presents a problem. We'll talk about the answer on another occasion. Okay, don't lose sleep over. Shabbat kesef. What's the difference? There's nothing. And Kushe Kesef is not beferish in the Torah anyway, and you know that. Right? Okay. So, anyway, so the bottom line is that's why this formulation, the first known coinage, I think, is from the kingdom of Lydia in 6th or 7th century BCE, the first known. Again, the truth is, could be there were, and nobody, and the archaeologists haven't discovered. But even if it wasn't, it doesn't really present the kasha you need to lose any sleep over. Okay. That the din that when you po demaser sheni, the chachamim hold that sartaha kesef biyadcha, that you can't use ingots, you have to use kesef sheisha of tzura, minted currency. Okay, fine. All right, so that's enough of moar. And what's moar habsulos? It obviously implies there was a known moar habsulos. And if you're chazal, immediately, what does there have to be? Well, since it's identified. And everything is going to be identified somewhere in the Torah, presumably, if it's relevant. So therefore, you turn to the other parsha, and you say, so it has to be Chamishim now. And the drush of Chazal, and I think it's, I don't know if Rashi quotes it, in the Gemara is, Kesef Yishkol Kemor Habsulos, She Yezeh Kemor Habsulos, Umor Habsulos Kezeh. Because this parsha tells us, Kesef Yishkol, Shkalim, Chazal's reading, and the other parsha tells us how many, but it doesn't tell us what coins. It only says Chamishim Kasef. So our parsha teaches you it's Shkalim, and the parsha of Ones teaches you it's Chamishim. There was an alternative choice. What was the alternative choice? What? No, that's not, in terms of parshias. What?
You could say it's a different value.
What's the value? There's only one other alternative.
Well,
And the Midrash Halacha explain. Somewhere they explain why don't choose it. What's that? 100, which is the Motzi Shemra. Presumably you don't pick Motzi Shemra because conceptually it's not Moar HaPsulos. He married the woman. He's claiming she wasn't the Pesula. Ones and Mefateh, the common denominators, they're both Pesulos, that he's taken their Pesulim, and therefore that's why the two would be naturally tied together. Okay, so now, if we have no further questions about Mefateh, yeah.
I would assume, when I read it, I was in the Mohars, and Moar HaPsulos is an additional sum that's added, which may or may not be 50. Chazal said that it is, but it's like you could have said it's a different number.
I would argue that Pshuta Shemikra is that, well, Pshuta, the Torah is not befeirish, but I would argue that there was a standard price. Societies had. And look, it's true today also. And not so much in your circles, not so much, but you go to firmer circles, and there are very clear set expectations who's supposed to get what, and what kind of thing, and so on and so forth. You know, they seem very, again, unromantic to us in the sense that they might be very romantic when you give the gift, but the idea that it's an obligation that they have to get the candlesticks, and this one gets that, and the other thing, and so on.
But even in secular society, there's the concept of, like, oh, you should spend, like, 6 months' salary on the
Right, okay, right. So, right.
Six months,
that's a lot.
6 months is a lot.
Maybe if you're making minimum wage or less, you know, or work something, okay. But whatever it is, 6 months on the wedding might be shy. Anyway, so the point is there are such expectations. I suspect whatever it is, whether really Pshuta Shemikra is 50, I don't know, but Gemar Absulos, it's some. Okay, fine. So now, go to Sefer Dvarim. Parashas Ki Tzeitze. A week from Shabbos. Ki yim sa'ish na'ara v'sula asher la'orasa. So firstly, the guy finds her, which is interesting. Right? It's like they just happened to meet up in a dark alley. You know, yim sa'ish almost implies he wasn't stalking her. You know, it was a crime of opportunity.
The previous two passages about yim sa'ish, if you find a woman anarama or asa of the ear or in a sadeh,
yeah.
So it's just like preserves the parallel with the previous two parables.
Okay, fine. Well, you're not going to use your fateh anyway because of what's about to come next.
Certainly not.
Nara visula shela or asa. So here we get the word nara as well. The Ramban talks about that issue, and then usfasa, which means he grabs her. The same word is used, by the way, in the parashah of Sota. Vihi lonispasa, right? Now, sota's only when she wasn't raped. If she's raped, she hasn't betrayed her husband. And lest that seems strange to you, and that's why does the Torah have to tell us that? About umala vomal, right? Why is it she lonispasa? Think about contemporary, a lot of Arabic culture, right? In other words, there are cultures like that, I know of all of it, where the woman, you know, they don't really care what the woman's role is. If she's not a virgin anymore, so her own family might turn on her and kill her. And that happens even in situations of rape. So clearly the Torah assumes that when the woman is not at fault, she's not at fault. Right? So by sota, she hasn't betrayed anyone when it's vihi nispasa. Right? That's why the sota only applies vihi lo nispasa. And the roots, and I suspicion, by the way, although I don't think you see that, I haven't seen an ancient Eastern law, I suspect that in the contemporary with the Torah, there probably were societies in which they didn't really care whether the woman was a willing partner or not. It shamed the family when she was raped, and they might have been willing to kill her just as well. And that is simply, in some cultures, has been retained. So here it's usfasa. He grabs her. Vishachav ima, as we spoke about already. And it's interesting, vinimtza'u. What does vinimtza'u mean?
Discovered.
And they were discovered. So of course, as a halachist, there has to be meaning to that term, and we'll say nimtza means be'edim. It's intuitive here because the next part says he's got to pay. Now, let me ask you a question. And if they weren't caught, he doesn't have to pay? You mean rape is okay as long as you don't get caught?
You can't pay.
Punishable. So the point is, it's not punishable, right? In other words, it becomes he says, she says. Or it could even be she doesn't even know who the rapist is, right? That's often. It's not often. It's often the case. It's probably a minority of rapes.
Isn't she not even allowed to testify in court in these particular cases because it's not dina mamonas?
Well, she couldn't testify for so many reasons. Well, she's no gea b'davar. She's a woman can't testify. But a man couldn't testify either. She's an eid echad. She could have been mitzaref. But the point is, it's normally a crime done secretly, right? But she said, okay, but a man couldn't do the same thing as well. There are cases in Sanhedrin that talk about this issue. You know, by Mishkav Zachor, the whole issue of someone was ma'anes, a man. What? It's in Sanhedrin Makos, right? Correct, correct. It's Ploni Ravani, Lone Sealer Tony, that whole sugya, right? So she's an Ogeba daughter, right? She's been injured by someone.
Is a woman ever allowed to testify?
In terms of formal edus, no. A woman is not, she is not an aid.
What is the halachic reason for that?
The halachic reason that's offered traditionally, some would call, I don't think it's necessarily apologetics, you might like it or not, is that being able to be an aid means you can be forced to be an aid, and a woman is not forced to be an aid because she's not forced to come to court generally. unless she's one of the Bali Din, which in fact in most cases she's choosing to come to court, but a woman will not be forced to testify. There is a suggestion, but that's maybe drush. Don't know why. In contemporary Dine Torah, we don't generally rely upon strict edus. We rely more upon umdana, in which case women will also come and present the story and what they've seen because it contributes to umdana. If you're asking, it's not about a lack of, certainly in Chazal, it's not about a lack of nemanus. There's a, I think, I hope a famous Gemara in Ksubas. Everything's in Ksubas. I want to say it's in round off Pehei Pevav, about Mepach Shvua. About if someone says that, you know, if someone is not Neman on a certain Shvua, the Rabbanon, they're a little chashid on a Shvua, so we may reverse the Shvua onto the other party. And if it's one party is supposed to swear and pater themselves, and the other, but we know that he's chashid a little bit, so we'll have the other party swear to collect. We'll reverse the Shvua. So there's a Gemara tells a story about, I think it was Rava. It was Rava. Who was going to impose a shvua upon some guy, shvua the rabbanon to pater himself, and his wife Bas Rav Chista said he's chashud. You shouldn't, don't trust him. So Rava was mapach the shvua, and in another case with Rapapa, same thing, and Rava wasn't mapach the shvua. So Rapapa said, you know, you believed her. So he said Bas Rav Chista kimlan libegava. I know she tells me something, it's true. So atlo kim libegava. I don't know when you tell me something, I don't know that it's quite as reliable. Right, so it's not about nemanus. It seems to be about some, it may be about role or something like that. I know it's a question.
Melech wasn't forced to be an aid either.
Correct, and therefore Melech is disqualified to be an aid. Yes, a Melech cannot be an aid because he can't be forced, compelled to testify. It's not called Malchus, and therefore he can't be an aid. Okay.
Fun question. I've heard before that in theory, if the Sanhedrin were around, they could read it with Drasha and then make it look good. Is that...
It's possible. It depends whether the din is a din which is Makubal Misinai, or if it's a Dvarim Shotziu B'Derech Hasfar. Forget. I don't even want to go into that.
Sorry.
I don't want to go into that. Okay. You, that's a Sunday question, if you want. Okay. Fine. Okay. So presumably there has to be evidence. Then V'Nasan Ha'isha Shol Chayv Ima. So again, the payment is going now, as was implied. See, in the Mishpatim, it didn't actually say who got the money. It says he has to pay money. Kesef yishkol kemo absulos. But it doesn't say who receives the money. Here, it says, v'nasan la'vi hanara. Chamishim kasef, and v'lo siyel isha tachas asher ino, lo yuchal shalacha kol yamav. All right, so she will beat him for wife because he afflicted her. He is never allowed to divorce her. Okay. Fine. Now, one of the questions, so we spoke about yesterday, obviously it can't be against her will. And the Ramban talks about that also. You can't have a chote niskar. The one exception to the rules we mentioned, or the question you have to ask, is what if she's not suitable for marriage? What if she is? He's a Kohen and she's a Grusha? Or she's a Mamzeres and he's a Yisrael? What would the din be? And it's not a crazy question to ask. You know, what? I'm sure I mentioned this last year, but when I teach Eridea, so I like to quote a comment in the name, I didn't hear it, I heard it klisheni from my wife, from Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, who said that learning to run a kosher kitchen by studying Eridea is like learning how to drive by reading an accident manual. It is the nature of halacha, obviously, to pick on the outliers because those are interesting. But the Gemara observes derech agav, the oddity of our parak that we're doing. I don't know if any of you, some of you read the first Mishnah? Eilun arash yesh lam knas. How does it begin? Haba al hamamzeres v'al hanasina v'al akutis, and then on a giores and a shifcha and a shvuish and niftuv shnirskayv v'shtachu v'pusav shasham echad. Haba al achosav v'al achosav v'al achos imo v'al hanida, and so on and so forth. Right? You just couldn't have a nice, you know, guy and girl who couldn't wait, you know, for the wedding or something like that. You couldn't have a simple case. Only psuos. Right, you have to start with, you don't start with the din of Habal Anar is Chaya Chamishim Kesef. Okay, so the Mishnah never tells you basic din, it assumes you know the Psukim. But you have to come up with all the Pegumim first. You couldn't talk about a normal case. You couldn't have presented the dinim of the Perek that deal with what is a Mefata pay, what is an Ones pay. Okay, now by the way, you know, these are sort of the odd cases. What if she happens to be a Mamzeris and he can't marry her, right? Isn't that a little bit odd? So it is sometimes the nature of rabbinic literature. It's true, but I think that there is another observation borrowing from Ramban here, is that I suspect that many of the cases of Ones, and especially Ones more than Fata, that Ramban says it Dafka by Ones, are the people in society who are vulnerable. It also happens to be, by the way, a fact that people don't like to talk about. Many states now have laws, you know, like Megan's Law in New Jersey, those of you who know what it is, you know, about people who have abused and raped children. And the truth be told, those laws are very, very complicated laws, and in some cases they're very, very negative. They're bad laws. They're punitive in a way that's destructive to society and destructive to rehabilitating people in cases where they can be rehabilitated. And the reason why they're passed is because people get hysterical over terrible stories, which are the rare occurrences. In other words, the abuse of children by strangers is an extreme rarity, and it's a distinct minority of cases of child abuse. Virtually all incest and abuse of children in this context, virtually all of it is by acquaintance, and probably a majority is by relatives. That's the way it is. And thus, and at some level, it's not strange to see the Mishnah talking about Oni Semifate by Achoso and Achoso and Achosimo, maybe a little bit odder, you know, and to talk about the question of Bito, where you're Pater because of Kavli Ramine. Those are not odd cases. Those, unfortunately, are probably the typical cases. So, in some sense, from Diber HaKosev Behove, it's not a strange question to ask what happens, even though Velosiele Isha, what happens when, in fact, the person cannot marry the person that he was onei somafata because it's a karo, because it's a psuyichos, because it's either a relative whom they had access to, because it's someone who's the downtrodden in society whom they could take advantage of. It's not as odd as it seems to be talking about those cases. But you have to add, the pasuk may not present it obviously, but what happens if the man is not allowed to marry her for other halachic reasons? John?
That's the thing that's troubling me, you know, the two pieces. Is that one seems much more forceful and one seems much more trying to persuade them.
Well, that is the difference between the two parshias. So that's why we call one a mafata and one an ones, and it's why Chazal ascribe very different punishments.
But then you can't tell me about. Why are you talking about the cases of the downtrodden in society? It would be for cases of seduction and mental coercion. It would be
so ones more so. Ones more so than mafata. The way the Ramban form is, and it's correct, is ones, although right. But I would even say it's true by mafata. In other words, if you would think about stereotypically, right, the woman whom is sleeping with a whole bunch of men, right, it's not the woman from a stable background, you know, just to speak in general terms, right? More stereotypically, so we think of the person who is marginal, right, who's coming from a difficult family situation, and so on and so forth, right? And remember that in some level, mamzer and mamzeres represent difficult family situation. It's a product of some kind or another of that. So I'm not suggesting that every case of this is one of those. I'm not suggesting that, but when you think about what the Mishnah chooses to talk about, the Gemara asks the Kasha, by the way. The Gemara says, Hani Naris in Ksheiros Lo? It's the open first line in the Perek. Right, what about a regular case? Right? So the Gemara says, no. Eilu Naris Psulo Sheishlan Kanas. Right? So again, the Gemara doesn't explain why the Mishnah didn't start with a basic comment, but it's worth giving some thought to. Okay. Fine. Any questions about the psukim? Any further comments? Adin?
This is projecting back to Mefata. Does the absence of Nimitzahu in Mefata mean that we rely, as this will come out tomorrow, that she could just say, he seduced me and stop with me?
So, you know, the answer to that question is probably, not in Chazal, and I doubt... In other words, the Torah generally, the Torah speaks about all sorts of niske mama. It doesn't talk about, in each case, what the level of proof is. In other words, it's always, whenever you're learning these cases, you have to separate out the facts from establishing the facts. Right? You have to separate out the law versus evidentiary procedures. Both are important. I mean, evidentiary procedures themselves are law, but we're usually not concerned about that, but you can't assume that the Torah was assuming something. Right? The Torah does assume, al pi shnayim edim o shloshayim yakum davar. Right, so you do have to assume that there are some rules of evidence that are in process here that the Torah just doesn't spell out.
So what's the chiddush of having in sa'u bayonis?
You know, I suspect because, as someone said before, all the previous ones also, right, in other words, by eshes ishezinsa, there you have to catch him because nobody else is coming forward with a claim. Right, at least by the rape, it's possible that someone came forward and said, she said he raped me, and he said, you know, for example, no, I seduced her. Lest you think that's not a case I'm making up. The Rambam is big machlokas. The Rambam write about certain aspects of that issue, and there's even mod the b'miksas issue there. So, in other words, you could envision a case, right? It's every case today in the college dormitory. He raped me. No, it was consensual, right? You could imagine such a case. You don't really always require edus for the larger aspects of the case. Okay, so we have just a few minutes, and. I'm not going to try to read them. I want to read them. Yes, Ezra Sherman?
Why is there no A in Nara?
So generally in the Torah it's spelled without a He. It's probably, Pshuto Shemekra, it's probably reflective of an archaic spelling without the Eim HaKriya, because that's all it's missing. And think the Shlosha Sifrei Torah Nimsu Bazara, if you took intro and learned that Sifrei at the end of Dvarim, Ma'on and Ma'ona, the Sefer Ma'on. Okay, which is not Ma'on, it's Ma'ona without a hay. Chazal do comment about this, and they, I don't remember, I think it's in our Masechta, they have a comment that if it doesn't say I have the hay on there, then the Chachamim Darshan, even if it's a Ketana or something like that, I don't remember. There's a Drasha Chazal have about that. There's a discussion of that. I don't remember what it is. But Pshuta Shemekov, that's just the way the word is spelled. Okay. So the last thing I want to do, and we'll stop with that, is just to read the Mechilta. I'm going to spend a few minutes on the Ramban tomorrow. I'll read parts of it. I'm going to read extensively. I would like to move on to Mishnah and Tosefta. Just the Mechilta, the Rashbi. Can I get a volunteer reader here for 2 minutes? Okay. Eli, go ahead. Ima'in
yima'in
aviyah.
Ima'in yima'in aviyah.
So that's the father. Biyadah minayin. How do you know she can refuse? Double language, ma'ini right. Ma'in, which the Bavli attributes as a general machlokas, Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael, whether you darshan the double language because you say that you don't say dibra Torah kalashim ben adam, or you don't darshan the double language because it's normal biblical Hebrew and dibra Torah kalashim ben adam. Okay, aval. Right, that's very interesting. As one of you asked me in Seder, I forget who was asked me. What's strange about that? So it says, first it says, Beferish, who eino yachal lema'ein? He can't refuse. If the father and the daughter say, you know, if he's the wealthy heir of some major conglomerate, and he's worth, you know, 9 or 10 digits, and, you know, they're very happy that he seduced her because now she's marrying into a wealthy family, and he says, listen, I'll pay you whatever you want, I'm not interested to marry you. So, she marries her, and they're many states' laws, she'll get half the estate under some circumstances, unless he has a really good prenup or something like that, or trusts. So she wants to marry him, so he doesn't want to. Eino yachal lema'ein shemer velosi eli isha. Okay. What's odd about the pasuk? What's that? It's by ones. It's not by mefata.
Yeah.
They're using the pasuk by ones. So here is a case of a harmonization of an intertextual reading where they are applying, on the literal level, the din of Velosei Elisha to the din of Mefateh. The $64 million question is he allowed to divorce her according to the Mechilta Rashbi? In other words, what's that?
If they're harmonizing, I would assume.
You're correct. If they're harmonizing, I would have taken the second half of the Pasuk also. And once he has to marry her, he also can't divorce her. Because what's the point in Alpisara, what's the point in forcing him to marry her if he could just divorce her? Especially if Ksuba's not the Raisa. Right? That's of no benefit to anyone. So, postures is the Mechilta might very well hold. Meinfer will hold that he has no right to divorce her. And yes, if once you're harmonizing, why don't you apply the din of lo siyeh li isha, lo yuchal shalcha koimav to the other? You see?
And also the money would be paid right away, like if I own.
So that mistama would be the difference. You know, the difference would be is that here is that if the only you don't have to pay the 50 kesef if they marry. By ones, they marry and you have to pay the money.
So he doesn't have a choice. So if he has to marry her, he can't divorce her when he
has. No, but the father can refuse.
Oh,
whereas
the
there, if the father refuses, you may or may not harmonize. It could be the din is the same, right? In other words, it could be that it's Mishnah Torah, right? I don't know, and the Mechilta is still probably not going to go that far, even though we harmonize most things, but I don't think that they don't harmonize. In other words, nobody says that in the case, I think the Mechilta, even the Mechilta Rashbi, and the two separate Mechiltas, probably does say that you pay the Knas immediately. You pay the Knas immediately. In fact, I think I'm pretty sure, because that's the next passage, it's right here. Okay, so now go ahead. Lesitalo. Go ahead, Eli. Lefi. If the father refuses, then he has to pay. Lefi shematzinu ba'ones. Exactly that. I forgot it. It slipped my mind. Exactly that. Lefi shematzinu.
Ba'ones shenu ten kenasa.
Miad, you have to pay immediately. Lesitalo, right? No, if he refuses to give her to him, then he pays. Magid.
Magid shenu hayav.
Fine. Okay, so we'll leave it. We don't have to read any further. So the answer is that would be the difference according to the Mechilta. In other words, he has no right of refusal in either case, but they both have presumably the right of refusal. The Mechilta says here the daughter does. Presumably, if you have a right of refusal by Mefateh, which she was willing, you certainly by Ones have the right of refusal. But here, if they refuse, you pay the Knas. But if she marries him, there is no payment. Whereas by Ones, there's a payment regardless.
And Shiotzi over here also means divorce, like
so that's the Bavli gets stuck on that as well. The Mishnah said that the Ones is no semiyad mafatel Shiotzi. The Gemara says, who says they were married? So the Bavli rereads the Mishnah is kishelo yechnos, not kishayotzi. All right, well, we'll talk about that eventually. Okay, so we will stop here. So